Well, one of the reasons I'm wearing my robe today is because I've got a bandage on my left leg, which is supposed to be sitting up in the air. Last year, the doctor wanted me to take some fairly heavy-duty painkillers because of it. I wouldn't. The highest I'll go is aspirin, because it would just dull my brains, and I object to having dull brains. So you learn to sit beneath it if there is actual physical pain. You literally learn to sit beneath it. It's the only answer I can give you. It does work. You can do it. It's not as simple as it looks, but it can happen. Was that the whole of your question? Okay. I was having a bit of difficulty today because where do you put a leg? You know, they're sort of attached. Yes.
I heard someone earlier mention the term detachment, and I've read and
yes.
saw them books about
yes.
it. Describe it.
Detachment. You know, no English word ever really describes certain things perfectly. It's like my worry about the word carefree, which also could be translated as detachment. Don't get involved in. You can't be totally uninvolved, but don't get involved. There is a natural involvement, and there's a deliberate involvement. And as I understand it, that's how you have to understand attachment. We're all part of the human race, but you don't have to deliberately get in there and try and solve every single problem. A couple of years ago, we had a Mr. Fix-It in Shasta, didn't we? The result was a catastrophe. But it is good to want to help. It is good to have compassion. It is good to be concerned about the human race. But remember, you can't do everything. When you can't do everything, or when you can't do something, get out of the way and let those who can do it. That's also under detachment. And that's one of the hardest things to do. You got any better clues to give him than that?
I always tend to think of it just in terms of the stillness of meditation.
Yeah.
It's so easy to react to something. And we can learn still first,
yeah.
and then be able to act out of that stillness, I think will not create a lot of problems for ourselves,
mm.
for other people. But you have to be able to get out of the way first to be able to see what you can do or can't do.
In many respects, the story I told of the monk and the puddle was a matter of detachment. The other one was still attached to the girl. Why are you still carrying her? The other one had got involved, dumped it down, and gone on. He wasn't attached. That's detachment, too. But he still did a compassionate act. He was acting out of the stillness, exactly as Eckhart said.
The motto of the World Federation of Buddhists is expect the worst, hope for the best, and do the possible.
That's literally the motto of the World Federation of Buddhists. I write for their big magazine. You do the best you know how. And that's really all the Eternal ever asks of you. I can remember asking Kuo Zenji what he wanted me to do, and he said, the very best you can. And I was annoyed about this, because, I mean, that's not much. And I went back and meditated on it. Oh, wasn't it? You don't realize fully how much that actually is till you try it. And that's detachment. We've got about 10 minutes, so there's room for another couple of questions. Yes.
You always talk about the law of karma and somehow the effects of karma can happen immediately or much later on.
Yes.
And also the fact that, well, the law of karma is something that's compassion and there really to help you. I was wondering, if it's there really to help you and you have, you know, effects that happen, you know, way down lifetimes away or, you know,
yes,
10
yes.
or 20 years. You know, that doesn't seem like that would be an easy thing to learn from. You know, they talk about if you have...
If you are thinking of yourself as an individual, it isn't. But if you are thinking of the whole of life as something that is constantly moving towards perfection, then it can be very helpful indeed. So long as there is the thought of an individual... Yes, it's not necessarily very helpful. Yeah. How about you two saying something since we've run out of questions?
Any more questions?
One thing I was thinking about in this question was when you begin to remember things that have happened, you know, reap the consequences of the things that have happened 10, 20 years ago or further back, it gives you the opportunity to give thought to what you do now, which may have consequences far into the future. So it gives you a deeper perspective in one sense. What you choose to do, and you not only think about what the immediate consequences will be, but what they will be further on.
Also, past life can be in this lifetime. Stuff that you've perhaps almost buried because their memories were so painful can come up in meditation and show you how they are affecting you now as an adult.
One of the things that Reverend Noster has taken great pains to teach us is that hindsight is an exact science. It's probably the only exact science. And it's easy to look back and say what you would have done had you known what you know now. But there's also the expression, you know, that good judgment is based on experience and experience is based on bad judgment. So you try to do your best with compassion and learn from your mistakes. What Buddhism is not teaching perfection in that sense, but what it is teaching is hopefully personal responsibility and just doing the very best you can to do the very best. And when you really begin to set your mind to what the very best is, your idea of the very best is constantly expanding. Because what is going to be the very best for us now in this moment, perhaps in another day or 2 days or 3 days or 3 years, might well be different. But the most important thing is that it just keeps getting better and it keeps getting clearer. And if that's happening, then you know that you're making some kind of progress. And don't expect too much.
In the end, don't expect anything, as Corpo Zenji told me, which is why when something happens, it's such a glory. You weren't disappointed. Yes.
You aren't sitting there saying, is it happening yet?
I've had a couple who did that. Are we enlightened yet?
Are we enlightened yet? Are we having fun yet?
Yeah. The man who after he'd learned the 26 letters of the alphabet asked his tutor if he could pass the worst because he wanted to go to Oxford. the lines, you can get very close to that sometimes. Very close indeed. A past life experience does not have to be from a life before this one. It can be of this life. Something that you buried deep that was so horrendous can come up. I have had at least two people who were seriously damaged as children by parents, and they have put it totally out of their minds. And one on one occasion screamed when she was looking at the wall because the memory hit. She got all the other stuff out of the way. And suddenly this came up, but she was able to face it. She was able to do something about it and see how that had controlled her in her adult life. So this sort of thing can happen on occasion. It just popped out. We could lose something that was totally buried. All past life, yesterday's past life, the 5 minutes ago when I said this is past life, you have to know what is meant by past. It doesn't have to be from another era or another time. But it is a jangle. And that, for her, had been a terrible jangle in her childhood. That's how it comes about. Well, we've got about 3 minutes, so perhaps before they throw us out... Oh, there's a question? Great. Do it because you don't do it because you think about the karma. You do it because it's the right thing to do.
And usually, don't you always usually feel better when you do it? Doesn't it kind of go along with your real true nature to go to follow the precepts ultimately?
Ultimately, one instinctively wants to follow the precepts. Yes. Ultimately, one does. One does not do it because of fear of karma, which is what I was saying to our friend here. If you're faced with a situation, if you've got to do something because something much worse is happening, you can't afford to be a coward on the karma. That is one of the gravest faults, and I shall be talking about that in one of the scriptures tomorrow in the Shishogi. Dogen actually talks about it, and he doesn't pull his punches.
Sometimes doing the right thing is extremely difficult.
And painful.
And very painful.
Yes.
But to turn away from doing the right thing, you know, is even worse. And it's, you know, whether or not you can live with it in not doing it. But Buddhism teaches to be able to look sort of things in the face and to do the very best you can, to know that in certain circumstances you will make karma, and not to be afraid of doing that, but to do it because it is the best that you can do under the circumstances. You cannot get to a state where you don't make any karma.
Yeah. I can remember several Japanese Zen masters saying, if you study meditation, if you meditate and you study, you will be completely free. And a lot of people said, wow, that means we can do exactly as we like. No, it doesn't. It means that you have made the precepts so much your own blood and bones that you are totally free. It just would never occur to you to go against them. And there is total peace within. It does not mean, well, I've done so much meditation, I've learned 300 odd koans, now I can go out and have 6 wives, 30 children, and God knows what else besides. No, that is not freedom. That's downright stupidity. And that is not what the Buddhas and ancestors teach. I just wanted to put that in, because one of the saddest things, as I said at the very beginning, is that a lot of teachers came to this country with the best of intentions, couldn't speak the language well enough, and a large number of muddles have grown up in consequence. And I often think of myself as a karmic road sweeper, going around picking up the muck that everybody else has left lying about. See you tomorrow, friends. Now, I'm sure those of you who have had anything to do with Taoism or have read anything on Taoism realize that one of the things that they have in big Taoist temples is a very pictorial hell. It is complete with all the torches in statue form, and they also have some fairly pictorial heavens in statue form. Buddhism in the Far East does much the same thing in order to show people what is necessary, but the chances of having an actual hell depicted are a lot smaller than in Taoism. Usually they will do something quite different. This afternoon I will show you the way in which the temple from which Soto Zen derives its lineage, Tenguzan, in China, I will show you how it is set up with halls and statues, etc., to depict the stages of development from when one first feels the necessity of religion through to the time when one has finally comprehended and knows the eternal. In the meantime, this morning, we need to look at the five chapters of the Shushogi to see what is needed as a basis for these five ceremonies. It should be clearly understood that Jukai is not just for children. Anyone wishing to be a full Buddhist adult and recognized as a full Buddhist adult by the Buddhist church should take Jukai at some time or other in his or her life. Go through the five ceremonies, spend the week in the monastery, living as do the monks, doing the meditation, going to the ceremonies, and especially the five special ceremonies that are laid on. The first of these ceremonies is the reading of the precepts, telling you what it is you need to study in great detail if you would become a true Buddhist. The second of these has been very badly translated as confession. There is no such thing as a confessional as such in Buddhism. But there is a time when you look at yourself and say, yes, I did this, that, and the other, and I swear by all the Buddhas and ancestors I'm not going to do it again, recognizing that you may possibly get caught, but you're going to pick yourself up and do something about it. This is called Sangha in Buddhism, S-A-N-G-E. It is a Japanese word which it comprises confession, contrition, wish I hadn't done it, try not to do it again. Anything around that it includes. But it does not imply sitting in a small confessional stating all of your sins in a list. I had one person on one occasion, who had been brought up in a Catholic convent school, who could write out the most magnificent confessions. They had taught her how to organize them beautifully. What they hadn't taught her was how to actually confess within herself to having done the things. What is important here is being able to see you've done them and do something about it. Being able to look at it. And anybody can look down at the mud and say, oh, isn't it an awful mess? But you've got to look at the mess and say, yes, mud isn't very pleasant, but remember that the lotus blossom has its roots in the mud, comes up through the water, and looks at heaven. Mud can be nutriment if it is looked at correctly. It can show you what not to do and how to train. So you do not look at what has happened in the sense of, how dreadful, evil, wicked, bad, and nasty I am, but I was something of an idiot. Let's not do it again. There is a great difference in the way in which one looks at this. So the second chapter, for lack of a better term, I'm going to use the word confession or contrition, or an act of, what's the word they use? Utter contrition, I think it is. Perfect contrition, which also comes under the same thing. So that is what the second chapter is about. The third one is how it speaks of the importance of not merely hearing the precepts, but absolutely receiving them quickly once you've realized what it is you have been doing. The fourth one explains to you the sort of behavior that comes out of having actually done this. How the world will perceive you as a result of taking charge of your own life. And Buddhism really says you must take charge of it if you will be an adult Buddhist. As a result of taking charge of your own life, the four signs of enlightenment, we shall be going into them today, so that if you are trying to help your employees or to really keep the precepts in the place you are working, what you should be showing to the people around you in the everyday world, which are the signs of working towards Buddhahood. And the last chapter speaks of putting the teachings actually not only into practice, but showing gratitude for them. The recognition ceremony. So, the first chapter of the Shushogi speaks clearly of why one comes to religion. And again, it speaks of the most important opposites, the ones that people almost never speak of, life and death. Chapter 1, The Reason for Training, says the following. The most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely and to be able to live without fear beyond them. Should you be able to find the Buddha, i.e. the eternal, the unborn, undying, uncreated, unchanging, should you be able to find that within both birth and death, then both birth and death vanish as problems and as opposites. All you have to do is to realize that birth and death as such are not to be avoided, because you have found the eternal. If you can understand that birth and death once you have found the eternal, are indeed nirvana, or that place wherein there is neither birth nor death. If you can understand this, there is not only no necessity to avoid birth and death, but also nothing to search for that is separate enlightenment, for you will be enlightenment itself. The understanding of the above breaks the chains that bind one to birth and death, fear, terror, etc. And therefore the problem, which is the greatest in all life, must be completely understood. The final koan, the final of all, how to live completely, taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the teaching, taking refuge in the priesthood. In that place, there is no birth and death, no fear, and of course, no pride of attainment. So the final opposite, falls away. And yes, one is sometimes sick, as the world understands it. I have sometimes got the impression from talking to people concerning birth and death that they are surprised that the Zen masters of old are dead. They've heard that you live much longer. It is certainly true if you learn to live without fear, your body does last a lot longer. The average Zen master, unless he has a mortal illness that he's inherited or that he's had before understanding, or even sometimes afterwards, as a result of an illness that has given him another illness. Usually, such a Zen master will live on the average 10, 20 years longer than most people. But he is not God, and he will wear out and die. Zen meditation is not a cure for physical death as we understand it. It brings about total peace with regard to spiritual death. But the body is still going to disintegrate, fall apart, and die. Otherwise, all the Zen masters from the beginning of time would still be wandering around, and some of them, I suspect, might by now be a bit cranky. This is not going to be an absolute cure so that you will never die. There is not magic in this. But if you can totally live beyond fear, you will last an awful lot longer. One presumes that everybody wants to. Sometimes when I'm out on the freeway, I wonder, but that's another matter also. So, yes, you will possibly live a lot longer. And you may also be able to live without having to take a lot of the things like heavy painkillers and the like, because you have learned to meditate and you can handle the thing much better. But you will still need the help of doctors, and Buddhism should not be substituted for visiting your doctor. I say this because occasionally this has come up. Well, I thought if I came and meditated, it would cure this and I wouldn't need to do anything about it. Anyone who says I advocate that has not listened to anything that I have said. Sometimes one needs a doctor's And one should not impose the idea on another that a doctor cannot help one physically. So, Dogen continues. It is very difficult to be born as a human being and equally difficult to find Buddhism. However, because of our good karma, with the karma that we have accumulated, we have received the exceptional gift of a human body and are able to hear the truth of Buddhism. We therefore have the greatest possibility of a full life within the limits of birth and death. It would be criminal to waste such an opportunity by leaving this weak life of ours exposed to impermanence through lack of faith and commitment. We are here speaking of real life. To leave it by not training ourselves to a seeming non-continuous. Now they are speaking of the good karma. There is also a handful of good karma that we each get, which, as I understand it, is roughly in ratio to the size of the horrendous handful we've picked up as well, so that we have something with which to work in order to cleave. That is how it was taught to me. Now, there are some things that are, of course, unprovable scientifically, which is why I'm saying this is what I was taught. It works for me, but I can't give you chapter and verse because I haven't got it. Fair enough. Impermanence offers no permanent succor. The impermanence of this life. Therefore, it is imperative to find that place where life and death do not exist. On what weeds by the roadside will the dew of our life fall? At this very minute, this body is not my own. Life, which is controlled by time, never ceases even for an instant. Youth vanishes forever once it is gone. It is impossible to bring back the past when one suddenly comes face to face with this impermanence, that all things pass. And it is impossible to look for assistance from kings, statesmen, relatives, servants, wife or children, let alone wealth and treasure. The kingdom of death, as the world understands it, must be entered by oneself alone, with nothing for company but our own good and bad karma. Therefore, to find the eternal is imperative. Avoid the company of those who are deluded and ignorant with regard to the truth of karmic consequence as a result of breaking the precepts. The three states of existence and good and evil. The three states of existence, past, present, and future. And good and evil. If you do not know how to do the best you can to get beyond them. It is obvious that the laws of cause and effect, which is the law of karma, is not answerable to my personal will. For, without fail, evil is vanquished and good prevails. If it were not so, Buddhism would never have appeared and Bodhidharma would never have come from the West. One must understand these three periods of time, past, present, and future,
very thoroughly what you did yesterday can color what happens today, and what you do today will color what happens tomorrow. Dogen wrote a very fine treatise called Uji on time and the importance of studying time and the seeing how going back and even over the time of one's birth, back beyond that, can still affect one. Unless one understands this very clearly before undertaking and training in the way of the Buddhas and ancestors, mistakes will be made by many, and they will fall into difficulties, and in addition to this, their lives can become evil, and their suffering can be prolonged. One has to study what happened yesterday, or as I said, what comes up as past life stuff in this lifetime. I spoke to you yesterday about someone who remembered something that happened in her childhood. One has to look at what happened then, the way it affects one now, and the way it will affect one in the future. And cutting the chain of karma, as it is called, is recognizing what one has done or what has affected one, the way it is affecting you now, and saying, no, it's not going to affect me that way in the future. I'm going to take charge of this. I'm not going to let it happen. And this also comes under confession. To a very large extent, one of the things we have to do in meditation is forgive ourselves for what we were forced to go along with as children, because we had no power to alter it. One can frequently forgive other people, but to forgive ourselves for being too weak to handle the situation is one of the biggest problems I've found that people have. I have often thought, especially when hearing stories of young people who have been handed back to the custody, is the word they use, which I find disgusting, the custody of parents. I've often thought the incredible damage that that can do to a young person who knows quite well, far more than frequently the judge does, about the parents. Now, in many cases, this is not true, and the child is wrong. But in some cases, the child is not wrong. The child is quite right. I am thinking of one who at 17 was terrified that her mother was going to be taken to jail for stealing. And the mother insisted that the child went with her when she went on the sprees. Guess who was really going to get blamed if it ever got caught? But she was under 21. She had no power to help herself. And the fury in that child was incredible. One sits back and says, who is really the adult here? But try and make the law understand this. So a lot of the things that come up in meditation is the realization that you were helpless and had to go along with things that you knew were wrong. And as we hear all these ghastly stories of child abuse, this becomes more obvious as we hear them. So remember that one of the things that is likely to come up in meditation are these sort of things that have happened in past life. And it is frequently happens that someone will suddenly burst into tears sitting beside you in the meditation hall. Now, they usually do not want to be touched, but sometimes they do, and only instinct can answer you as to whether or not this is the right way to go. But do understand, if it happens, they are trying usually to forgive themselves. Only last night I had an incident of the same sort of thing as someone who had been meditating deeply and was trying to forgive herself. She was crying terribly on the phone to me. Was trying to forgive herself for having had an abortion. How could she have done this? If you meditate, you're going to have these things come up. And please, if you meditate properly, remember that they will happen. And if you do confide about them to a priest, it is absolutely duty-bound by that priest never to reveal name or person, place, position, anything of the sort. It is a totally confidential matter. I only mention this because it does happen. And when you are meditating, don't be frightened. Don't think that you need psychological or psychiatric help. These things come up because you're taking a look at you. And they can and will come up. Past, present, and future. It can come up from when you were, excuse me, 2 or 3 years old, and it may not come up till you're 40 or 50. As I said, usually the life after this one is regarded as about 10 years, but it can be left on the pile for someone else to pick up. Rebirth. Right. It is important to know, and this above all is important, that there is no damning, eternal damning, in Buddhism. One of the beauties of looking at the pictorial pictures of hell, of the hells, is that they are all temporary. You stay in a hell until such time as you've learned the lesson that you should have learned that put you there in the first place, and then you're straight out of it. There is never a permanent damnation in Buddhism. But a lot of us put ourselves through a hell in this lifetime as a result of memories and sometimes of things we can't remember, but which will come up in meditation. And it can be very rough going through those. And you really, even if you're meditating alone, you want to know someone, a priest, a relative you can totally trust, someone whom you can confide in and feel safe that they will not betray their confidence. See, all of this comes under confession in a funny sort of way, but it's not a confession as the average church understands it, Christian church. Or I don't think it is. I have to be careful on that because I don't know enough about Christianity to answer the question well. So, remember what can come up. And remember what is past life stuff. Now, this is a paragraph I mentioned yesterday. None of us have more than one body during this lifetime. Therefore, it is indeed tragic to lead a life of evil as a result of not knowing what can happen to us as a result of what we have done in the past, and not cutting the roots of karma quickly. For it is impossible to escape from karmic consequence. If we do evil on the assumption that by not recognizing an act as evil, no bad karma can accrue to us. Now, there was a lady sitting over there yesterday who spoke of what about the responsibility of something. Supposing you see something terrible happening, should one do something about it? It specifically speaks to this in this scripture. I'm not going to make karma. I'm not going to get involved. The argument that if I get involved, I'll make karma, you bet you'll make karma. And you'd still better get involved, because if you don't recognize an act as evil, it's going to be far, far worse. You're an ostrich with your head in the sand, not recognizing evil. And yes, there will be consequences accruing to you, and you better know it before you stick your head out and do something. I have often had to break precepts in order to prevent something much more serious from happening. The consequences to myself for one of these acts was absolutely horrendous. But I'm still glad I did it, because if I hadn't, Buddhism could have been really seriously damaged in a certain country. But I'm glad I did it, because it was the only thing to prevent something else much worse from happening. So you cannot and must not be a coward. Buddhism does not breed cowards. But you do as little damage as possible. And as we said yesterday with regard to the Buddhist motto, hope for the best, expect the worst. It's the expecting of the worst that people don't like. They sort of, well, maybe I'll scrape by. No, expect the worst, because it's much worse if you don't expect the worst. And do the possible. That way you can handle it. That's the first chapter. That tells you what you, the type of mind, the reason, and the why of coming to meditation, and above all, of wanting to be a Buddhist. It is, I'm going to take charge of my life. And at the first ceremony of Jukai, the priest says, you bet you're going to take charge of your life. This is what you're going to do. And he tells you the precepts. He explains them to you. What I explained yesterday, the Kyoju Kaimon, the 10 precepts, the 3 pure precepts, and the 3 refuges, which are the 3 Buddha precepts, the 3 refuges, that is part of that very first ceremony. That is what is read to you by the priest. He then says, will you for this next week keep these precepts? And the people answer yes. That ceremony is done in a big guest room. The priest, at the beginning of the ceremony, if you've got a big enough temple, and next year with any luck we should be able to do this in Shasta, because we finally got our big guest house up, although it's not as big as I'd hoped for. Apparently, it's more expensive to put up a two-story building in this country than it is to put up 2 single-story ones, which blows my brains, but that's neither here nor there. So we've got 1 single-story, and we'll get another one later. What you do, 2 or 3 of the chief guests, they elect who shall do it, comes to the guest master with incense and asks that the congregation may be given the precepts. And he asks if any of them would rather not be given the precepts, in which case such a person is asked to leave for this week. Then the guest master goes to see the Kyojushi, as he's called, which is the precept master, asks him to administer the precepts to these worthy people who wish to practice the Buddha's way for 1 week. And then the ceremony takes place in the guest hall. It does not take place in the main ceremony hall. It takes place in the guest hall, and it is incumbent upon the Kyojushi to study the faces of the people to make sure that they all are in agreement and that none of them look as though they are fighting the idea. That's not always easy to do, since all you have is candles to light the room for the day, for the evening, and it usually takes place at dusk. Then you have what I spoke of yesterday, and with the comments of Keizan Zenji, which I read to you. Having done that, the people are then invited to meditate and instructed in meditation. And that ends their first day there. The following morning, they are expected to get up and do exactly as the monks do from the point of view of attendance, services, and meditation. And usually that day, I'm talking of a complete week now, and you've got 5 ceremonies, you've just done one. That day, usually people spend carefully examining their consciences, thinking of how best they can handle each precept. The Chinese have a very interesting system. They allow people to take as many precepts or as few as they want. Supposing I think the term is working girl, comes wishing to do Jiu Kai. She will not take the precept against what I think is adultery in Christianity. I can't think, what's the right term in them? That's right, wrongful sexuality. Occasionally I can't remember something. She will not take that precept. A shopkeeper will frequently not take the one against stealing because he's not quite sure about the amount of profit he's making. And so it goes on. You take as many as you know you are really going to try and keep. Which, if you think about it, makes a lot of sense. Don't try and guarantee something for a week that you're not sure you can manage. And if that person is sincere, and usually if they do it that way, they are very sincere. If that person is that sincere, by the end of the week he realizes that you can't really cut one of them out, or any of them out. And I have known prostitutes change their lifestyle totally as a result of going to Jiu Kai. And I have known at least one butcher who walked out of his profession and found another job. He realized he could not continue and be a Buddhist. So it sometimes does cost to do this thoroughly. It's worth it, that I assure you, but it sometimes does cost. So, you spend the day meditating deeply, looking at what perhaps needs to be changed in your lifestyle, so that not only can you go back to the world yourself having benefited from this, but you can be such an example to others that they will want what you have. Now, as I said yesterday, greed can be used positively. Remember the story I told of tying my shoelace and everybody thought there was bread? And the villagers who were wondering why I was looking at a wall. Or the small children, the same thing. If you are going around your work not tearing people up, looking good, obviously not scared, somebody is going to say, what she got, I want it. And that is how Buddhism is spread. By showing the signs of enlightenment. And there's something inside everybody which we call the seed of the Buddha nature that will respond to that on seeing it coming out of you. Now, the second chapter, this usually takes place, the ceremony for this usually takes place on the third day of Jukai. Up until now in Shasta, we have had to do this one primarily by the weather, because you need a large outdoor procession. We finally got most of the cloister up there, so this coming year we will not be at the mercy of the elements. And since, as I said yesterday, the only month of the year in which that area has not seen snow is August, and this takes place in April, a cloister is really imperative if you're going to do Jukai properly. Some of what Dogen says. Freedom from fear is gained by the recognition of our past evil acts and contrition, therefore. That was the only way I could translate Sangha. The recognition of what we've done and the saying of, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm really going to train myself not to do it. I knew of one person who every time she failed to keep that promise to herself, gave herself a penance, she was coming out of the Catholic background. Now that is a perfect example of how one's former life can affect you in training. I am not saying this is wrong. She was incredibly sincere. But I am saying that one needs to look at what one does in order to deal with the present so as to recognize when one's past karma is working upon one. Dogen openly admits, and so does Kazan, that one's past karma can still work upon you. And you need to be aware of yourself enough to know how and why. There's nothing wrong with doing that. It shows great sincerity of purpose. But you need to know that that's why you're doing it. Right. Because of their limitless compassion, the Buddhas and ancestors have flung wide the gate of compassion to both gods and men. And although karmic consequence for evil acts is inevitable at some time during the three periods, contrition makes it easier to bear by bringing freedom and immaculacy. As this is so, let us be utterly contrite before the Eternal. You remember Moggallana yesterday, who was beaten to death by the thugs and who first ran away in order to avoid it, and then meditated deeply and realized that this was the karmic consequence for ill-treating his parents, and accepted the karmic consequence. The law of karma is inevitable, and it has to be worked out at some time or other. And if there are jangles left from down the centuries, someone picks them up and is given enough good karma, which is the essence of the Buddha nature within us, the essence of the Eternal, to mend, not mend, to clean and be compassionate for that karma. Contrition before the Buddhas brings purification and salvation. I hated the word salvation because I knew the way in which it is comprehended by most people. Salvation, as I have used it here, means freedom from the fear of birth and death. But I didn't want to keep on repeating the same thing over and over again. Once aroused, the true conviction of the necessity to train changes all beings, in addition to ourselves, with benefits extending to everything, including that which is animate and inanimate. We no longer kick the door down if it won't open in a hurry. We take the trouble to find the key, putting it in the best way I know.